you're going to have to get a bigger place soon. You know, all these talks, they are streamed live. We always have problems with getting enough bandwidth on the internet and always problems with the technology. But it's wonderful to know that if you can't come here on a Friday night, you can always see this live at home. And many people watch these Friday evenings all over the world, literally. And even in places you're not supposed to watch them, like in Iran or Afghanistan, I'm not sure where. It's wonderful to have that opportunity. And in these talks that I try every Friday evening to have, to use the Buddhist principles, you know, to try and look at problems which we all face in our daily lives. So that this is not just a dead, dry sort of teaching of Buddhism, it actually works and how it works. For example, that every time I teach a meditation retreat or just do some meditation, just like now, just beautiful, peaceful meditation, I didn't want to come out. Sometimes people, when I teach them, say, yeah, it's okay when you meditate, but what happens when you go, you know, into the real world? Which I say, what do you mean? Meditation is the real world. The world which we happen to experience after we come out, that's called the fabricated world. It's not real at all. Is it real? You know, look at your wife in the morning before she's got her makeup on. What's real, what's not real? Look at you when you haven't brushed your hair and brushed your teeth and had a shower. What is real, what is not real? So I always call that world out there the fabricated world, and the reality is peace of mind, kindness, compassion. That's the reality. But I have to go out into the fabricated world again and deal with the problems of this world, because Buddhism is not just a religion which sits down there and does nothing. That's our home, that's our resource, that's our zero point. We go out there to try and help people. And there's this beautiful balance between compassion to yourself, which energizes you and gives you power, and then using that energy and that power, you know, to go out and help other people who are not so fortunate. And so the reason why I wasn't here last week was because I was doing those sorts of things. I went to North Vietnam for a conference, and it was United Nations Day of Waisak celebration. In 2009, it was a Sri Lankan ambassador to the United Nations in New York requested that this Waisak celebration, which we're going to hold here on Sunday, become like an authorized United Nations holiday. You know, Buddhism, one of the big religions in the world, it should be recognized. So from that time on last Tuesday, Wednesday, depending on which day you took Waisak to be, they would have had a little ceremony in New York. But also that one city every year holds a big conference. And I was interested in this year's conference because it's United Nations sponsored Day of Waisak, they wanted to have a conference on how Buddhism was dealing with the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, which many of you may have heard of, but I bet that most of you don't know what they are. This is 2000. United Nations said, okay, let's do something for the millennium. Let's actually, everybody, governments, big religions, organizations, let's do something like, you know, primary education, healthcare, you know, maternal health, sustainable development. And the one which I was interested in, because you may know me by my history in Buddhism, is the third United Nations Millennium Development Goal, which you all know, gender equity. And many of you may also know, if you saw the little program running on the TV screen there, and the latest news from the Buddhist Society of West Australia, just only very recently, was it a couple of weeks ago? We had another ordination of, we call them bhikkhunis, not bikinis, bhikkhunis. I say that word because sometimes we say another word, it reminds us actually, you know, what the real word is, and it's close. Well, not the same.
of like women is full ordination, just like monks, just like in the time of the Buddha. Another four women, you know, took her full ordination as nuns. And this is maybe the only city in the world which has such a sort of equity in our leadership in Buddhism. So when I saw there was going to be a conference in Vietnam on gender equity, I wrote a paper and it was accepted. And that's where I was last Thursday, Friday, Saturday, over to Vietnam to present my paper to leading Buddhists. And as soon as I got there, the first day, a senior monk approached me and said, "Ajahn Brahm, your paper has been banned." All that way I could have been with you having a nice Friday night talk. I was not allowed to give my paper. And I'm saying that, so this is, goes around the world. Anyone in United Nations who listens to this, I think you should investigate that. This was supposed to be how Buddhism is dealing with the Millennium Development Goals. Number three, there's only eight of them. He's actually trying to get gender equity in this world. Everybody knows it's really unfair if anybody is discriminated against because on the grounds of things like their gender, their age, their race, their religion, that's just, it's untenable, it's uncompassionate, it's just unwise, it's just unhelpful in our modern world. So that's what I did, and I tried to sort of push it along a little bit further. And so, but because, you know, this is in Buddhism's own backyard, you know, the gender equity issue is suppressed. So what do you do? Now that's what I go, and I go and do this and fight the battles. But what I'm trying to say now is, how does a Buddhist deal with something like that? You know, when you can see like hypocrisy at some of the highest levels of your organization, an inability to even discuss the issues, and how do you actually deal with that? Now how we deal with that whenever there's a big problem like that? Using Buddhist principles. And one of the biggest principles, which I hardly ever talk about, is patience. Because I know that sometimes some of these issues, they do take a long time to get to your goal. You have to be there for the long haul. It does take time. And your job is to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And never give up. The problem is that sometimes we have this, because you're a Buddhist, you understand how this mind works. And also you understand how things happen. So you can use patience and Buddhist psychology basically to get your own way sooner or later. First of all, the patience. Now this is something which, you know, I read in, of all things, the Chinese Art of War. It's the Chinese Art of War, they just use this little book, you know, how to win battles. Okay, so life is sometimes a battle. It's only a euphemism that use a military metaphor. But they said, never go in battle against an enemy who's more committed than you. It doesn't matter just how powerful you are. If the other side is not as committed as you, if they haven't got as much moral authority, as much ethical power as you, even though you may be weak in your numbers and weak sort of in your armaments, you're going to win in the end. It's the power of the ethics, the power of your commitment, the power of your determination to keep on going. And eventually, you know there's no force which can prevent that type of commitment. So as a Buddhist, in anything social issues, please never give up. If you're really committed to something, then eventually you're going to get to that goal. I remember that. Look at this center here. You know, this is, I don't know if people remember, this is my 30th, well, actually tomorrow, Sunday when we do our Waisak celebration, this will be the 32nd Waisak ceremony, which I've been to here in Perth. I've been a monk 40 years this year, 32 years in Perth, or 31 years, but I came just before Waisak. So this, and when we, if any of you were here at that time, remember just a tiny little group we had, really tiny, just half a dozen people, that's all. And just the commitment to actually to work, you know, my life's commitment to work building up these places and actually getting to where we're going. It's a huge journey. And that huge journey means you're never, ever going to give up. You're always going to keep on going. And if you look at any successful people in this world, you find their level of commitment, their endurance, their patience. Eventually, you will get to that goal. It has to be a worthwhile goal. When we do set goals, please make them worthwhile, not to be rich. That's not a worthwhile goal at all. Come on now. You know, just look at the rich people in the world. Is that what you want to be remembered for? The richest person in the cemetery? Is that really, you know, what you want people to, you know, to sort of remember you as the great, you know, football star of whatever club you follow? Don't you want to actually do something in the world to actually to help to make this world a better place? If anyone wants to know the meaning of meaning of one's life, that is to make this a better place for the people who are going to come after you, not a worse place. And how you do that, you know, so many little battles to be won. But find one and commit to it and keep on going, and you get there. And just, you know, this organization here is just a testament to just that commitment. Keep on going. In fact, even in the path of meditation, for those of you coming the first time, yeah, they keep telling me, yeah, I meditated, my mind was all over the place, so I can't meditate. What do you mean? That's the first meditation you've done. You don't going to get anywhere in life. You just think the first time you're going to get instant rewards. And something like meditation is going to be something that's going to build and build and build and build. And if this is what it's like now in your life, I don't know how long you've been here, imagine what it's like in another 5 years, 10 years, 20 years' time. And many other skills which you can develop in life, you know, learning how to play the piano, learning how to play tennis. In the end of your life, you won't be able to do that. But the end of your life, even when you're sort of geriatric, you'll always be able to meditate. That is something which you'll be able to do throughout your life to the very end, and that will give you the greatest gift of all: peace of mind in your later years, stillness at your death, and for those of you who believe in rebirth, a beautiful rebirth afterwards, and those of you who don't believe in rebirth, a beautiful rebirth afterwards. So this is actually what happens. That's why it's really good to commit to something which is really, really worthwhile. So there's many, many things. Sometimes people ask, hey, jump up. You should be fighting this course. You should be fighting that course. But we can't fight every war on the planet. So that's one thing which I was really fighting for gender equity. And, you know, and we're actually leaders in that. But when you get frustrated, be careful. Frustration is not a good Buddhist response to things. So as soon as I was told, no, you can't present your paper, that was the first thing. Why? This is unfair. You can't do this. This is United Nations. I'm going to protest. Come on, that's not how a Buddhist works. A Buddhist is much more sneaky. So instead, we just sit there. Don't be frustrated. Because the frustration, you know, it means you had expectations. It is the expectations we have to get our own way quickly, to achieve our goals, you know, according to our agenda. All those expectations which we have in life are the cause of suffering. And the frustration, why isn't this happening? Come on, be real. How long have you lived in this world? You know, people are just, they're hypocritical. You know, they're egotistical. They have their own ideas and they will stick to them, you know, quite doggedly for a long, long, long time. So one of the first things we learn as a Buddhist is to be realistic about the nature of the people we're dealing with. This is why I often say, if you want to be effective in life and want to be have a happy life, lower your expectations. We have such high expectations of life. And because we have so high expectations of life, of people, of governments, of, you know, even monks and nuns, sometimes instead of actually being real, we look at those expectations, we get frustrated, and when we get frustrated, we get angry, And basically the baby goes out with the bathwater. So when we lower our expectations, we are actually living within the realities and working within that, and that's where we become successful. We understand what we're dealing with. And when these sort of obstacles happen to you in life, you don't give up. You expect that. You expect to have obstacles on your path to achieving what is good in life. You anticipate them, and you have strategies to deal, you know, with what happens. So, you know, I was stupid there. I should have expected that. You can expect anything in life. You know, you can expect when somebody rings you up and says, "Oh, you know, your friend has just died." How many times has that happened? And people think, "What happened? They're dead. That's something gone wrong." That's not correct. If you'd actually looked, if you'd have looked at the agreement before you were born, at the contract, you would have seen there was a clause in the contract before you were born that you can die at any time, in any place, for any reason, at any age. So stop complaining when it happens to you. There's a contract, for goodness sake. But somehow or other, that in our life we have what's called in Buddhism delusion. Instead of actually what's really real in life, you see it happen to everybody else, you know, sometimes we think that something has gone wrong. I'm just going off on a tangent here, but this is a very beautiful simile which somebody told me, which I often bring out, you know, when somebody young dies. It was a simile of the leaves on a forest. Because I remember this is a lot of the teachings of Buddhism, or, you know, the Dhamma, they actually come from nature by observing real life. Because it's nature, real life, teaches us much more than any books do, or any monk does, or nun does. Go out there and see the world. I already mentioned one beautiful thing with nature. Crooked trees are the most beautiful. So if you have a crooked husband, he's gorgeous. If you've got a crooked nose, don't go and have surgery on it. It's wonderful. But this particular story from nature was a monk told me this story. And he was, years and years and years ago, because I've been 40 years as a monk, he used to, you know, hang out with his monks from 60 years as a monk. So this is, no, I don't know, 80, 90 years ago. And he was living in a jungle like most monks used to do. And just in a simple hut with a thatched roof, you know, meditating, living a very simple, peaceful life, you know, in a country in that time which was undeveloped. And unfortunately, one evening there was a storm, and the storm was very, very violent, and trees were falling down, and he got concerned. It was only a thatched hut. If even a big branch fell on top of the roof, it would go straight through. And even if he wasn't killed instantly, that would be the best. If he was injured, broke a leg, no smartphones, no doctors within sort of 100 kilometers, you know, in the jungle in those days, you know, who'd die slowly instead of dying fast. So it's really, really dangerous in a storm in the forest in a thatched hut. So he's meditating up all night, hearing all these big thumps and thuds of trees and branches being uprooted. But he survived, which is why he could tell me the story, obviously. And in the morning, he said, he got up, it was light, storm had finished. He went out to see the damage, and he said a couple of trees had only just missed his hut. He was very lucky to be alive. But what took his interest, which was the heart of this anecdote, were the leaves on the forest floor. Because most of the leaves, which lay dead on the forest floor, were old brown leaves which had lived a full life on the twigs and branches. But amongst those old brown leaves, there were many yellow leaves, you might call leaves of middle age. And there was many green leaves as well, young leaves, and he even saw a few leaves which was that bright green color that you'll recognize if a leaf has only just sprouted forth that very day, they too lay dead on the forest floor because of the storm. He looked up to see what leaves were left, and as you expect, mostly green leaves still alive on the tree. But even though young green leaves had been torn off and lay dead on the ground, you know, there were still a few old curly brown leaves still clinging on, even though many green leaves had been torn off and lay dead. Do you understand the simile? Like the winds of a storm tear through a jungle, through a forest, they take mostly the old ones, a few middle-aged ones, some young ones, and a few babies as well. Just like the storms of disease and accidents, they take mostly the old ones. And even so, even though some young ones die, there are still some old curly brown leaves, and some of them are sitting here. Still clinging on, even though the young ones die. So they understand from that nothing has gone wrong. That's nature. Nature is teaching us something there. That nothing has gone wrong. You can't get frustrated. Getting angry is misunderstanding the contract of this life. And it's the same with just, you know, people's stupidity sometimes. You know, I remember as a student reading Voltaire, you know, this great French philosopher. And one of his quotes, which I will never ever forget, and I bring up every now and again, because I was studying math and theoretical physics, the only way, Voltaire said, the only way you can fully comprehend the mathematical concept of infinity is to start thinking about the extent of human stupidity. That's true. You know, sometimes I'm stupid, you're stupid, we all do stupid things from time to time, some more than others. If you really admit it and you're honest, I do stupid things. So because of that, you know, we can expect these things. So when you're actually having a goal, even with some sort of great social goal, please, if you understand the nature of this world, you won't get frustrated. Frustrated just takes away, it sucks your energy. It sucks your ability to continue on that path. Because a lot of times, you see, from frustration, because we don't understand what we can get and what we can't get, our expectations need to be readjusted. We get frustrated. What's the next thing after frustration? Anger. And anger is a phenomena in Buddhism. We say it's never going to help. It's never going to work. Number one, anger really starts to suck away your energy. Anger just makes you do some stupid things you'll regret forever afterwards. Anger just takes away all of your moral authority as well. You're just this angry person. You've seen angry people. They really think they are right. They really think they need to do this. You need to be told. You need to be taught a lesson. Something needs to be done. In the end, the anger just ends up thwarting the main reason which you were acting in the first place. So I always, and you know, after anger, the next stage is, this is my theory. It'd be great if someone actually did some research on this. This is just my theory, just of observing the nature of the mind. First of all, you get frustrated, then you get angry, and then you get depressed. Much of depression in our modern world is because of frustration. And that anger is right inside of us. Angry at our partner, at life, ourselves. So angry, that sucks up so much of your mental energy, your life force, until you've got hardly anything left. You fall into this hole of depression, and it's so hard to get yourself out. Be careful. That frustration, anger, and depression, you can see just how one leads to the other. And you know that depression is such a huge problem in our modern world. Many of you may have had depression. If you're aware enough, you can actually see where it came from. So angry, you just give up. Now that is never going to get you anywhere in this world. So get rid of the idea of frustration. This is what you can expect. And instead you can start being sneaky. And the sneaky part of this is to know that, you know, number one, you keep going. If you keep going, eventually you must win. You keep going, try and get your word in other ways. And it doesn't really matter, because once there is a good idea and people see it, then of course it's going to get traction. You all know that if a book, unfortunately, you know, it's usually pornographic books, if a book is banned, it becomes incredibly popular. So I thank that committee of the United Nations International Day of Vaisak for banning my talk, because that gave it far more power. More people will read about it. You can actually see it on the internet now. So that's being sneaky. You know, say, thank you so much for banning my book. Now, or my son, whatever, it'll become a bestseller. So when it does get banned, instead of getting frustrated, you can actually see something positive, you know, in what happens. You don't always have to sort of see the negative side of it. And I've done this so often, the power of positive thinking. You know, shit becomes fertilizer for the mango tree. You know, whatever happens, you can always make use of it. And that's something which I have learned so often. You know, whatever happens to you in Buddhism, you know, for example, you know, we had this beautiful Vaisak ceremony here run by the nuns, like a meditation day on Wednesday. We had the full moon on Tuesday, a whole meditation day on Wednesday. I don't know how many of you came for that. Apparently it was very, very successful, except a thief came in and stole some money and some other stuff. Be careful. What was your reaction then? You're saying, oh, that's terrible. They came into a temple. No, it's wonderful. The whole purpose of having a temple is to give to people. To some people, they need Dhamma. Some people, they just need a bit of kindness. Some people need some money. So wonderful. You know, and it's actually from one of the, not the nuns, but the nuns' attendants' bag. So, you know, it's monastery money. So wonderful. Whoever gets that, may they be happy and well. Isn't that wonderful? That's another way of looking at it, for goodness sake. You've lost it anyway. You're not going to get it back. So why not turn that into something beautiful? When somebody came to me some years ago and they said that they had a burglar came into their house, I said, what do they steal? Are they steal all these expensive bottles of whiskey? I said, oh, thank the burglar. They stop you breaking your precepts. Thank you, thank you. What a wonderful burglar that is. Can you please get the burglar's name? I can give them the addresses of many other people sitting here today. So we can relieve them of their alcohol as well. So some burglars are very good. So this is always the attitude. Whatever happens in life, you can always turn it into something beautiful. And people actually come on, Ajahn Brahm, there are some really bad things which happen in life. Natural disasters. When I'm going to Korea on Monday, they say, I've got to really, really give some talks. It's high profile, you know, TV and everything. Please, you know, give some help, because in South Korea they are still really, really hurting. I mean, big time hurting with that ferry disaster. You know, the kids, hundreds of them who passed away unnecessarily. So how can you do that? Look, national disasters, whatever they are, they have benefits as well. The idea of bringing communities together, which always happens, you go through hell together, and then when you come out the other side, you have an understanding, a bonding, a relationship with the people you share that pain with, which no one else can understand. You have some wisdom, hard gained, but you grow enormously from that. Say it's the fertilizer factor. Natural disasters can be used as to get negative, angry, upset, depressed, again, angry at trying to blame somebody. All the time, look, you can't blame anybody. Everybody makes mistakes. And sometimes I feel very sad for the person who was on the bridge at that time, or they were captaining in the aircraft, or the person who was so-called in charge, because in our modern society, we're always playing a blame game. It's your fault, somebody's fault. I want somebody to blame. In that simile of the leaves on the tree, who was to blame for those young leaves dying? No one was to blame. It's nature. It's nature that there's volcanoes, there's earthquakes, there's tsunamis, there's disasters, because human beings are fallible. That could have been you on that bridge. And, you know, you're not a perfect person. Sometimes you make mistakes. You get tired. Sometimes you're playing around and make the wrong choice. You know, I was just talking to someone, actually. You know, I had a motorbike when I was young. Sometimes people have this stupid idea of a monk that I was born with a bald head and that I was always very wise and very kind and compassionate, never naughty, never done any evil thing. But I do remember when I had a motorbike, it's really dangerous things to drive. And I remember this experience, I really almost got into very, very bad trouble. I was just, under the speed limit or just at the speed limit down Notting Hill in London. On Notting Hill Road. It's Notting Hill, it's going down a hill, a slope. It had been raining, so the road was wet. And there was a car in front of me, and some pedestrian stepped onto the pedestrian crossing, without really looking. And so the car in front of me slammed on the brakes, and I slammed on my brakes, and a motorbike started skidding. And I remember this moment, I had a choice. A choice of just crashing into the back of the car, and don't know what damage it'd do to myself. I had enough sort of control to swerve around the car but not stop and just go through the pedestrian crossing without any control and maybe crashing into the pedestrian. One of those moments, you know what I did? Swerve around the car and take my chances. I just missed the pedestrian, thank goodness. It's really scary. Sometimes I made a choice. I could have been in jail for that if it didn't work out. You make mistakes sometimes. You're in these situations which, you don't make yourself, and there you are, you make a split choice. It's so easy to make a wrong choice. I was lucky. You've probably done things like that. Lucky that, you could have, done something which has got you in jail for a long time and just that's ruined everything. So don't be ever critical of people who make mistakes, because that could have been you. And anyway, I remember that time, and I remember just it's so hard to judge and hard to judge anyone. And so why do we keep blaming people? The blame game is something which will never help at all. And that's not part of Buddhism. No blame, no guilt. Acknowledge. Forgive. Forgive means no blaming. And we learn from this. So something like a disaster like happened in Korea. Acknowledge it happened. Please forgive. Because only when you can forgive, this is another thing. When you can forgive, people can actually tell the truth. They're not afraid of telling the truth when you know they're not going to be put in jail. Why did it happen? Instead of covering your ass, as they say, because you've got nothing to cover, nothing's going to happen. You're going to actually just go and tell the truth. All fear of punishment is what drives the truth underground. Well, we can't learn. And when we don't learn, the thing happens again. So when these mistakes happen, these are learning times, growing times, so we can make things more safe, more understand what goes on and why it goes on and make sure it never happens again. And surely that must be the real meaning of something like that. So whenever I get frustrated or like that, I learn why. You don't blame anyone, but you learn, find out why, and do much better next time. And anyway, I know that once things are out of there, once a genie's out of the bottle, as they say, can never be put back in again. That's one of the great things with the ordination of women over here. All those monks who try to stop me speaking, they may try and stop, but they can't stop what's happening on the ground. Something which was, and I say this because I'm embarrassed sometimes, Buddhism, real Buddhism, traditional Buddhism, I'm talking about traditional Buddhism, was so progressive. Gays, no problem at all. Gender equity, no problem. One of the big things the Buddha was on about, he failed, was caste in India. So you can't have caste. Why are you discriminating on one man against another man or woman just because they were born in this family or that family? That's one thing which he failed at. There's still a caste system over in India. But my goodness, the Buddha really tried his best trying to stop that. So it was very progressive in those times. gender equity and stuff. So that was traditional Buddhism. And so you get a monk, like a Western monk, who knows what they're talking about and understands these things. And this is what we're teaching over here. That was then, this is traditional Buddhism. I gave a talk at UWA some time ago, and about a month ago, and some of the students there said, oh, that's progressive Buddhism. I say, no, that's traditional Buddhism. What, traditional Buddhism? I thought tradition was conservative and backwards. But you look at, you come to the sutta classes. This is traditional Buddhism. The backward stuff is only what's happened over the last 400 or 500 years, where culture has come in and just messed up what was original Buddhism. So, because it's traditional, and because it's obviously ethically right, it's a force which can never be stopped. So you keep on going without getting angry. It's just like, the stories of people like Gandhi and Mandela. Always remember the Gandhi story. That was one movie I did see, because somebody showed it to me here. Sanat Dittisira sort of showed it to me, because this is a story you as a Buddhist monk should actually see. I remember when he was with the Brits, there's my ancestors. That's why I have to go over to Asia very often, to places like Malaysia and Singapore, to undo the bad karma of my ancestors. They're not such bad karma. They did lots of good things as well. I'm only joking. But I remember the point there. And this was, when the British Raj, this was the biggest empire in the world at the time, before the Second World War. And then the British Raj, and this guy, Gandhi, came in rags, and just with all these big, army generals of the British Raj having a meeting about what's going to happen in India. And they say, you're never going to be able to fight us. And Gandhi said, well, I don't need to fight you. You are going to walk out of India without a gunshot. And that just blew the Brits away. And that's actually what happened. It's brilliant that even though it was sort of like a cause which impossible to win by military force, by power of arms, or authority, or hierarchies. The Brits owned all of those. But the ethical argument, the power of what's right, that was something which no one could resist. The power of the South African army could not stop a Nelson Mandela. The power of a good idea, something which you know is right, which you know must go forward. As long as you can follow that and trust in it without getting lost in frustration or anger, that's going to win in the end, as it does. And again, as Buddhists, we can be very, very patient. People who only think they win live one life, they're going to get a lot done in 70, 80 years. But it's great being a Buddhist. Yeah, we don't get it done this lifetime. There's always a next lifetime or the lifetime after that. Don't worry about things. Don't rush. Because we see a bigger picture. You see that as well. How many times have you planted a tree? Knowing you're never going to see that tree grow to maturity. But does that really stop you planting a tree? You plant a forest knowing that maybe 200, 300, 400 years it's going to come to maturity and balance, and generations after you, not even your grandchildren, your grandchildren's grandchildren, but generations after that are going to enjoy it, and it's worth doing. Sometimes we forget that big picture. Sometimes we don't commit to doing something and seeing its return. We give expecting something back in return. Buddhism, we just give, expecting nothing back in return. Let somebody else enjoy the fruits of my giving. I won't be here to receive it, but it's still worth doing. That type of attitude is something which is needed in our modern world. Not quick results, not results which you will see this year or next year or 10 years or 20 years or in this lifetime or even in your next lifetime. You just keep on going because it needs to be done. It's something which you feel is right. This is the last thing I'm going to be talking about, the feeling that something is right and the feeling that something is wrong. I gave a talk last night at WACOS, West Australian Council of Social Services, And I'm just mentioning just, you know, about ethics. Has ethics got anything to do with religion? Has religion got anything to do with ethics? You know, as this world becomes more secular, less people actually follow religion. Trouble is, they don't follow religion, but they follow their thoughts, and they follow what they're told, rather than following their hearts. Because there's something which is even more powerful than religion. So where religions came from? Your hearts. Is something right? Is something wrong? And for years, I've trusted this, you know, more than anything I've read in any book. When there's a moral dilemma and somebody asks me, abortion, is that right or wrong? Euthanasia, right or wrong? What else is an issue in our world? Is it right or wrong? How does it feel inside? What's wrong with it? In here, you get the answer, not in your books. And it's because of that I told last night, I say it here again, never allow your learning, your religion, or your culture to stand in the way of truth. Okay? Your learning, or you've been told. This can't be right because I've been told that, you know, it's wrong to be a homosexual. My religion said it's an abomination. You know, the Buddha said, you know, you can't have euthanasia. It's Vaisak Day soon. Also celebrating the time the Buddha passed away. Did the Buddha commit suicide? Straight away, traditional Buddhists say, of course he didn't. Buddhism don't do suicide. And I do this to stir people up. The Buddha ate meat, some pork. Didn't he know what he was doing? Didn't he intentionally eat that pork knowing it would kill him? Isn't that suicide? And I do that because sometimes even good Buddhists, you know, we're not supposed to have dogma. We're really supposed to not just, you know, think for ourselves, you know, see for ourselves. But still, a lot of times we are just so restricted by what we've learned, what we believe, what our culture says. Even like doctors. No, it says, I've been trained, you can't do this. But they know in their hearts what they should do. I can't say that. You know that story I told a couple of weeks ago when this lady who'd been brutally raped and she came to me for counselling. When, you know, she told me what happened to her, I told her, you're so lucky to have been raped. How the hell can a monk say that? You're not supposed to say that. That's wrong to say that. But I did say it, and it worked. You can listen to the talk why that worked. I've said that many times, you know, that particular story. That was an occasion when what my culture taught me, what I'd learned, what I was in the books, what religion, what common sense said, I pushed that all aside. And I let truth come up. Never allow your learning, never allow your religion, even Buddhism, never allow your culture to stand in the way of truth which you feel in your heart. That's your ethical compass. And I can get onto that very easily because I've been meditating for, you know, 40 years as a monk, about 5 years before that. I am aware, I know what goes on in my mind, I can feel it. So please, you try and develop your awareness like that too. Really develop your mindfulness of your ethical compass rather than your thoughts and ideas. And then you know this is right. It needs to be done. You know, sometimes you don't know why it's right, but it is. Usually what happens, then I go back to the books, then I do research, and then I find out why it's right. I was right. It felt right. It smelled right. It was right. That is the ethical compass. Those are the things, you know, which you can learn in a place like this. I'm not teaching what's right and wrong. No one can. All that Buddhism, coming to a place like this, can never do is teach you how to find out for yourself. That's why it's not a dogma. And it's not a faith. It's almost like a university, like a school, teaching people how to grow up, open up, learn, be aware, and find out what's in the human heart, what's right, what's wrong. You go in that path. You don't need to convince people. The idea's out there. It gets in like a worm into their hearts. And it just works its magic, and people understand. Things like gender equity, things like lowering consumption, things like, you know, learning how to deal with overconsumption, materialism, where money becomes more important than love and family and kindness and is happiness and all this other beautiful stuff in the world, which we sacrifice just for an extra dollar. All that stuff becomes so clear and so obvious. Not just a thought, but it becomes who you are. So this is how social activism in Buddhism actually happens. It becomes very, very powerful. It's part of being a human being. It's not just for your own happiness and peace. It has to be for the happiness and peace, as the Buddha said, of all sentient beings. May all sentient beings be happy and well. And you can't distinguish one being from another. You are me, I am you. Thank you for listening. Da da da.
Very good. Okay, a nice, interesting, another talk. Buddhism applied. So, any questions about what I've just been saying today? Yeah. It's actually, because it was banned at the last minute, it's actually on United Nations Day of Vaisak website. But actually, maybe we can put it on the Dhammaloka website. Good idea? Yes. Very good. Okay, be on the website this weekend. Otherwise, I'll sack somebody. It's a very simple, you know, little paper. Just, as you know, it started off, interestingly, when was it? About 1955. There was a woman, a black woman, on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, sat on the prohibited section of the bus. Do you remember her name? Rosa Parks. She became a Buddhist. Did you know that? You see, why did she become a Buddhist? One of the reasons is because, you know, she probably did a little bit of research and realized that, you know, that Buddhism doesn't have discrimination. And, you know, from that, I said, she risked a lot doing that. Going to jail, being beaten up. I mean, taken to a cell and being very viciously beaten. I think she was for doing something like that. But she stood up, took a chance. And that's what happened. You know, the icon of the racial equality in the United States. I started with that. And I started, you know, this is gender equality. You have to make sacrifices. And then I went on to the sacrifice, a small sacrifice we made here when we first ordained bikunis. And then I went on to a academic legalities, basically putting all the other monks and nuns on notice that there's nothing wrong with it legally. All those arguments you've said for years meant you can't have nuns in the Buddhist monastic order. You can see, you know, from the text, from the Vinaya, from the legalities, there's no preventing of it. Legally, it's accepted. Scholars have done the work. There's no barriers except political. And then just saying, it's been well known, just quoting social studies, that when you give equity to women in any society, there's many other benefits, huge benefits, you know, and other unequal, you know, parts of society, violence, you know, child abuse, you know, I forget all the other sort of social indicators. It has a huge flow-on effect when you give equity to women in leadership roles. there is a glass ceiling. Not actually not a glass ceiling in the monastic order. It's not even a ceiling. They're not even in the room yet. It's a glass door. They can't even get in the room, except in Perth. So you say things like that, and, you know, because I'm a monk, because I've got power. I have got power, you know. I told a story to the nuns. Please, this is not blowing my own trumpet. This is just, you know, a fact, and it's good fun. It's why I can do these things. And it's actually just to show her just how powerful this Buddhist group is over here. I was sitting next to one monk. I told this story on a Wednesday night. Sitting next to one monk in this conference in Vietnam. He's a Vietnamese monk. And he turned around to me, as you do, and he asked me, now, where are you from? I said, I'm from Australia. He said, oh, really? Are you a disciple of Ajahn Brahm? And of course, you know what I said next. I am Ajahn Brahm. Because these people, they listen to the Friday night talks. You know, it's on the internet. You know, people, whether it's in Bangladesh, the Mukta here, in Bangladesh, they've started in Bangladesh. They've got many Buddhist monks there. They've been mostly staying in the cities. Now they started a forest monasteries. The forest monastery tradition is really taking off in Bangladesh now. Guess who's their teacher? They all come and take photographs. Ajahn Brahm. Because they get it on a Friday night here, on a Saturday afternoon. You know, all the stuff which you give here, you know, it's just all that little camera on the back there, that actually goes much further than you'd ever expect. And it's, you know, these are leaders of Buddhism for the future. So, oh, big round of applause for the web people. And if you come on a Sunday, we say we have this three refuges and five precepts. So actually, becoming a Buddhist. Some people say, how do you become a Buddhist? Well, really, it's in your heart. You become a Buddhist. You feel, yeah, I'm a Buddhist now. But sometimes, you know, you want to affirm it. You know, to your friends, family, it's like having a marriage. You want to say, this is the man, the girl I want to live with. Gay marriages are okay too. Just when the stupid government allows it, we'll do it here. So, please, I shouldn't say stupid government, but you know what I mean. So this is the way we affirm that we're a Buddhist. And there's so many people listen on a Friday night here in so many different places in the world. We have this beautiful event tomorrow. Is it 3:15, Lucky? 4:30. Sunday, 4:30 on Sunday. There'll be people like in, say, London or Toronto or Columbia or something getting up in the middle of the night watching through that camera over here. And as we give the three refuges here, you know, I do, you know, Budang, Savanang, Gacchami, they will be in sort of Ecuador saying Budang, Savanang, Gacchami, taking the three refuges and the five precepts for the first time. They are part of this organization. Throughout the whole world, they do this. And I'm always amazed when they give me the list of these countries where people are taking these precepts from here. And that's really inspiring. Because this service here, the talks, the sutta classes, all the other stuff we provide here, is just far more powerful than you'd ever think. So it's an incredible, wonderful thing our Buddhist society is doing. And trying to really help this world. So this is it's some of the momentum which, you know, is going to sort of have a huge effect. Good. Okay, any other question before we finish off? Yeah, go on. Yeah, I don't know if they have done it in the UN, but if you know anyone in the UN, please, you know, you just do a bit of stirring. If anyone watching here, you know, the United Nations has given their name to this group of conferences, and there you are having somebody whose theme was gender equity, and they're suppressing discussion of lack of gender equity in their own backyard. That is unacceptable. The Catholic priesthood, not having women priests, at least they can say, well, they haven't got any legal justification, it's their tradition. Buddhists can't say that. It has been our tradition from the very earliest times to have equity, to have women in all levels of the Sangha, of the monastic order. And you can criticize Catholicism for that, criticize Buddhism for it. Even in your country, in Sri Lanka, there are big... The country of your birth, sorry. Sri Lanka, there are bhikkhunis, but they're not acknowledged, they're not respected. That's not on. Traditional Buddhist country, you're supposed to be... No, Sri Lanka always looks upon itself as a guardian of, you know, true Buddhism. Okay, let's leverage that. True Buddhism has female monks. Guard them. There's a question over there somewhere.
Yeah, what did you want to be when you were a little boy?
What I want to be, well, it depends on how early I go. First of all, a train driver. Later on, when I was at school, okay, I'm being honest now, being the best lover with heaps and heaps of girlfriends. That's what I want to be. It never worked out. Very good. Okay. So anyway, we'll finish off now because it's almost 9 o'clock. So thanks again for listening and hope to see many of you on Sunday. And we'll just pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. If you want to know what we're doing, it's in the library. They've got some translation of what we do now. And if you want to stay behind to ask a few more questions, I'll be here for a while yet.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.